Welcome to Design Oracles. We are here to pontificate, evangelize, and educate you on residential interior design and architecture.
I'm Amity Worrell, interior designer of Amity Worrell & Company.
And I'm Diane Kett, architect of DK Studio and together partners at Amity Kett.
Thank you for listening. We're here with Design Oracles.
And we're going to talk about articulation of facade today.
Okay. What does articulation of facade mean, Diane?
Yeah. So facade is, you know, the building exterior, the walls, and articulation is how then that gets defined. You know, it's not just a, well, sometimes it can be just a plain wall, but typically not.
So like on a house, it's when we look at the face of a house, it's the kind of nooks and crannies, the setbacks and the forward parts of it, and then maybe the dormers and the projections and that sort of thing.
Yep. And materials, you know, might be a mix of masonry and siding, stucco, concrete.
It's like a way of adding character and variety to the exterior.
Right. And windows and how much glass versus how much solid and that kind of fun stuff.
Yeah. And so those will be, you know, relate to how the interior as well works out. And that, and when you're designing a house, you have to think about both of those at the same time. Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. And also the roof shape also adds to that too, I think.
Right.
Because you can have no roof, because the roof kind of starts to also add to the articulation of the facade.
Yeah, and I know sometimes when we're working together on a project and you bring to me an already sort of planned out space, and we want to make some, the client wants to make some change to the way an interior part of the space works. Maybe they want to add a laundry room or extend an area. Sometimes the entire exterior needs to be reconsidered because that projection changes the overall effect of the building.
Right. And sometimes they may just be working on an addition in the back and they say, oh, but we really want you to fix the front elevation.
Yeah.
You know, the facade. And we kind of look at, well, what's wrong with it? Why is it not working? Why does it not feel good? Why are you not happy when you drive up to your house?
And also, I think this is the part where we talk a little bit. This is where the rubber meets the road with whether or not you use maybe the front of your house to sit and have a cup of coffee in the morning and look out at the neighbors versus instead you like to sit on the side of your house because it's a little bit more private, or how to kind of use that undulation of space and those nooks and crannies and different materials to relate to the exterior so that you want to be there. So, you know, we've all seen those houses that kind of look foreboding from the front. And sometimes it's because they don't feel approachable. Maybe that's because they're flat oftentimes. And maybe that house is designed that way on purpose. It's not about spending time at the front of the house because maybe it's facing a busy street and all of the excitement happens, and all of the outdoor to side activity happens at the side of the house, on the side yard or in the back of the house. So it's not a good or bad thing. It's just a decision that you make when you're designing a house. It's what do you want, how you're going to use those outdoor spaces and how they're going to relate to the structure itself.
Right. Yes. I'm thinking about all those kinds of things. So it's kind of interesting because the, you know, we've talked a lot also about interior and connecting to the exterior. And so sometimes the building is often thought of as something that turns inward, but you kind of also have to think about how it is turning outward and how it's oriented to the outside, how it sits within the environment around it, surrounding it, and, you know, start to think about, like you had said earlier, some undulating areas to be as well.
Right.
I mean, because I think some of that variation in the articulation of the facade through materials and glass and windows and, like you said, maybe pulling and pushing forward some of those building planes.
Yeah, really, and I think sometimes when we've been working together on projects, we'll look at it and say, okay, well, this is a beautiful structure and I like the way it feels. And then you start imagining what it would be to approach it, as we've talked a little bit about in other podcasts. And then you think, well, maybe it needs a little screen wall. in this one section so that you feel a little more private as you're passing to the entry. Or maybe it needs a material change outside, maybe a porch area, so that maybe the whole house is stone, but you want to add a little bit of wood in one section. So it defines that area as an exterior room that you can sit in front of and engage differently with.
Mm-hmm.
So that's right. Where all that comes together.
Yeah. And also, you know, some of the maybe like porch roofs. I think porches also help with undulation of the front facade. One thing, you know, think about is like those really modern buildings that came out with the basically steel and glass, right? They felt like they weren't so engaging when they all first came out and you weren't really feeling welcome. I mean, I think what comes to my mind is some of those office buildings, right? And mm-hmm. you think about they just got plunked down there and maybe there was a fountain in front to try and soften it or something.
Yeah, it's like a spaceship landed.
Yeah, and you're kind of like, okay, I just need to get inside and get not be in this space, and you just don't want to hang out in it.
Yeah, and sometimes they even, those buildings, as we've probably experienced, create wind tunnels.
Yeah,
There's not undulation, so it creates this canyon of buildings, and the wind can just whip right through. So a lot of times it's landscapers that go back in, or exterior work goes in to try to create, like Diane says, maybe a water feature gets added, or an outdoor pavilion ends up mm-hmm. in later years getting added because people find that, and those, a lot of those buildings, people, the people who work in them don't hang out outside of those buildings because they're foreboding, and all they do is move quickly to their parking spot and get the heck out of Dodge.
Right. Yeah. And there's actually a study done that kind of human behavior study where they realized that people prefer to be on the edges of open spaces. And when those edges are made more human, they tend to cling to them. So thinking about galleries, and which galleries is kind of a term for like an open colonnade that's attached to a building, or columns itself, a little type of indentations, porches, benches, built-in benches, or sitting ledges maybe, that people then really engaged with the edge of an open space.
Yeah, we've all been to the restaurants that have outdoor seating, and the first tables that fill up, the request is always for the ones that are at the edges mm-hmm. or close to the restaurant, and so that people can sit with their back against something. And I do think that is comfortable for people. In watching people's behavior, they like to sit with their back anchored against something, or their side, or and then oftentimes too, just a little bit of covering overhead, even if it is an exposed bench, just a little covering overhead provides enough shelter that you feel like you've landed somewhere and you can be comfortable in that space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So like the trellises that we talked about in our outdoor rooms, you know, which can be made out of metal or wood. A lot of times you see those in the outdoor areas of restaurants too. So that, you know, engaging in that articulation of the facade. We also talked about the front stoop, the New York townhouses back mm-hmm. when we were talking about curb to door. So thinking about that as well is kind of a way of undulating that facade. I mean,
right.
You think of those really cool brownstones. They're pretty flat, right? It's one tall wall,
mm-hmm.
but they really undulate with how they work with the windows and then all the decorative features. Maybe they're brick, and so they work with how all the brick design that comes around mm-hmm. those windows and comes in and out, and the door might be set back just 1 or 2 feet from that front wall. And
gives you a little nook. Or there's just pretty plaster work that's decorative and projects off the face of the door above, so it feels like a little bit of an overhang. So, I think those stoops roll out the red carpet for people. The welcoming, it's this welcome moment. Place to sit, place to engage, and a place to step off of the sidewalk, perhaps, where people are passing quickly. It's a nook for you to step in. And then mm-hmm. there's also those kind of gated areas, too, that lead maybe to the basement apartment of those structures. And a lot of times, you know, in big cities, those spaces get furnished, and people use those as outdoor rooms, even though maybe they're trash containers around the corner there. But it feels comfortable because it's set a little bit below the sidewalk.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives people a place to sit and observe what's going on around them.
Right. Yeah. And so one of the things in elevations, I think, in articulating your facade is proportion. It's absolute key to having a successful elevation. So part of that proportion is working with the how much glass you may have versus how much solid wall, how much of certain materials you have. You know, maybe some of it's masonry and some of it is stucco, or maybe some of it's hardy board wood siding material, or maybe it's all that, but then we look at the different sizes of the lap siding or something like that. So really thinking about the proportion of the building, you know, there's the golden section that Palladio came up with, and I was fortunate enough to go study in Rome and really go draw all those different types of buildings and figure out how that really does relate. It's pretty interesting.
It's about like, that's about what too feels comfortable. It's like,
right, because it's related to the human
form. Uh-huh. Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's a lot of, you know, it's interesting how throughout history there have been moments where people are more attentive to that. It depends on kind of who's designing the house, whether it's, you know, just a builder or if there's a thoughtful architect or just having that knowledge of human behavior and scale and and people's desire to engage with material differently can change the whole way a space is designed. I want to bring up quickly one thing that I really love is side driveways or side garage entries, mm-hmm. versus the sort of garage right on the front of the house that can create a little bit of a foreboding kind of flat facade. Right. So setting that back, maybe how do you deal with that, would you say? Like, is it setbacks or turning them on the...
Yeah, maybe you can push them 5 feet or so back from the front facade. Sometimes the lot isn't wide enough to get the turning in from the side. That can be tricky, especially in urban areas. But yeah, when you have that front-facing garage, if you can set it back a little bit, that's always nice. But then sometimes we look at it as, okay, we have this big opening and maybe they want to make it that glass, depending on the style we're going for. Or sometimes we'll do it very simple and plain and it's almost like we want it to disappear.
Right.
And have it become part of that elevation. You know, maybe it's looking like it's part of the stucco or the siding. Sometimes, again, we might celebrate it and have windows and maybe it's a nice stained wood clad, depending on the style and of the architecture. Maybe that's picking up on some other wood elements in the front of the house. And so that, again, is part of that, you're right, articulation of the facade. Mm-hmm. It can be a huge component that we have to work around because we all want to park our cars in the driveway or put our – not the driveway – in the garage, or put all our stuff in the garage and park on the driveway. But it's definitely there, and we think about it a lot on how to deal with that. In fact, we just had a house we were working on together, and they wanted the glass doors.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of had to really look at the proportion of how those were working because they are front-facing. We weren't able to turn them to the side and really look at and the layout and the articulation of how we divided up the glass doors as well.
Yeah, so that it didn't look too – there was too much glass at one point as we were designing and looking at it. And then we were able to pull back and add some wood material and a little screening material and kind of some ideas of what where planting beds might go to get that interest there and to get the client what they want as far as the look of the space, but also get them what they need, which is that comfortable relationship to their house from the front.
Mm-hmm. And also with the dividing of the glass door, it also related to how we divided up some of the windows as well.
Yeah. So and I think of the whole thing at once. And I think that's the challenge is everybody thinks they know what they want in one little section. But being able to think about it in 3D and in volume and in scale all at once is the trick of it, right? Making it all kind of come together.
Yeah. And you know, whether it's a modern design, contemporary design, arts and crafts, Art Nouveau. I mean,
we love Art Nouveau.
Yeah, when you think about articulation of facade, Art Nouveau is really fun to look at with all of the curves and the use of iron and metal and how they would form some of the concrete even. It's
a lot
just
of work.
Amazing.
A lot of craftsmanship.
Yeah, a lot of craftsmanship, which is why it can't really be done today, but very amazing of how that is such a great example of articulation of facade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and talk about engaging with Art Nouveau. It's, you know, all based on forms of nature and, you know, humans love nature and that connection to nature. And so whether or not we realize it, we're very drawn to that, to those organic forms. And so having those in your actual structure, tricky to do, expensive to do, but so beautiful and engaging and relatable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the curves, and somehow that really does, I don't know.
It looks magical.
Junsequoia, right? Yeah, magical. Another thing that when I was thinking about what we're going to talk today with articulation of facade, I, you know, and thinking about all the different types of styles and thinking about the modern, I wanted to talk a little bit about the Barcelona Pavilion, well known by Mies van der Rohe in Barcelona. It was actually only standing for a year, and they actually rebuilt it in 1986. But it was, you know, to start this big, you know, exhibit. And so it was in a pavilion that was just for an exhibition. And what was interesting is I actually got to go visit it a few years ago. And, you know, I was kind of like, oh, Mies van der Rohe, yeah. Not always a big fan of his work because it doesn't always feel as good. Talk about the steel and glass. I mean, I can definitely appreciate it, but I don't always enjoy those spaces. So we went, and I was just kind of floored by the elegance of it and how great it felt. And
so it surprised you. It felt much better than you expected.
Me. Mm-hmm. And when you think about building edge and articulation of facades, so it's very simple, but they definitely articulated it, and there's a whole bunch of edges happening. Mm-hmm. So it's very engaging for people to sit and act and be all around in the space. And so you kind of just meander through these open rooms. The only things in it is the famous Barcelona chair and the statue that I can't remember of who, but he's over top of the big little, or not, it feels big, but it's not big.
Yeah, the scale of it's space. Small. Mm-hmm.
So, and the materials they used were marble, red onyx, and travertine. And so you get these great big swaths of these amazing pieces of material as you're moving through as well. So you're getting these great statements. And so it's just, it is an articulation, but it's simple and it still feels amazing.
And then I would say, too, that's the organic piece of it, too. Mm-hmm. It's not just steel. It's sort of natural stone, and there's natural movement in that stone, and there's different textures in all those stones. And that's appealing.
And there's also different ceiling heights. And sometimes you don't have something over your head, and sometimes you do. And so it just felt really amazing to walk through. And so I went in the gift store, and I looked up a book on it, and I discovered that he had this woman, Lily Reich, who worked for him and basically designed the whole thing and designed the Barcelona chair. So no wonder it felt so great, right? And of course, in school, we never learned about her at all. Mm-hmm. It Mies gets all the credit.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's really amazing. If you get a chance to go to Barcelona, just zip on over and go through it for sure, because it's an amazing, cool
space. I've
never
been. I would love to go.
Yeah. So I just wanted to bring that up. And also, who doesn't think about the Barcelona chair? What a famous icon of modernism and the modern movement.
It makes a statement. Clients have loved it since the dawn of time, since it was designed. And it really, when clients want it, it's based on that they love architecture, that they see themselves a certain way. It means something to them. And I think what's really comfortable about it is the scale, the width, and like the elbow room it gives you when you sit in that chair.
Yeah.
It's very, very comfortable. Mm-hmm. It doesn't take up a lot of space, but it provides a lot of comfort. It's a really magical chair. Yeah. On a side note.
Just a little side note. So going back, I guess, on materials, you know, how you were talking about at the Barcelona Pavilion, the red onyx, the travertine, the marble, and how that was so organic. So, you know, it's interesting because a lot of times people want stone or brick on their house. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I guess it's part of that connection, connecting you to earth and nature, maybe in some type of subconscious way.
Yeah, and I think also, you know, we want the exterior of our house to look beautiful with the plants and things that we grow outside and the lawns or whatever it is. And those complement each other really well, those natural materials that come from the earth relating to the green plantings and the trees and all of that just goes together really beautifully. It's different than a cityscape. Mm-hmm. Cityscape, there's less green space. So sometimes in the city spaces and more urban spaces, it's about trying to bring some of that nature in. And then in the spaces that are more lush and have more green, it's about relating to those spaces. Those materials tend to cost a little more, brick, stone. So we are always careful about how we use them and where we use them. Sometimes decisions get made about where the stone cladding goes on a space so that we get the most visual impact and engagement with a texture where people pass, and maybe other areas are stucco or siding.
And also thinking about the local materials. So one type of stone might be inexpensive in one area.
It's true.
And it's more expensive if you're trying to bring it to another area.
That's true, yeah.
I had some clients from Pennsylvania, and they really wanted that Pennsylvania bluestone on a house in Austin, Texas. And I said, I know it's gorgeous stuff, but it's not so readily available here, and it costs a lot to bring here. I think that's the second person I've had request that in Texas.
Yeah, I had one as well, same Pennsylvania bluestone, because they were from the East Coast. It was easier to get there. They thought it was just, you know, a nice, humble material. They ended up doing it because it was very emotional. They were emotionally connected to that material, but it was not an inexpensive endeavor. So, yeah, I think if you're careful and you think about your environment, where you are and what you can get there, and then try to love some of those materials, try to use them, that can be cost effective and also better for the environment.
Yes. And, you know, it's always fun to think about how is it that that material is so local, and then people do tend to just start to love it because it is local. So like the someone coming from Pennsylvania, so they're so used to seeing that Pennsylvania bluestone over here, that's what they wanted. I was in Wales, and I could not believe how much slate.
Oh, goodness.
There is. It is amazing.
Wow. Is that where it comes from?
It's just there. Yeah. And, you know, like everything is made out of slate. And yet it's so hard and expensive to get here.
That's so funny. Well, so interesting, because that really reminds me, too, of when we're building custom furniture and we're trying to decide what woods we're going to use, or maybe we're just making selections of wood materials for cabinets. Oftentimes we'll have that conversation, say, you know, or for wood flooring material, we say, you know, well, what grows here? What is prevalent here? That so that what we're standing on, or what we're touching, what we're engaging with, is something we can look out our window and see growing. And so for us here, it's oaks. You know, we have a lot of oaks, and pecan is another one. And pecan can still be expensive, but less expensive here than it is in other places. It grows very prevalently here. So that's an interesting thought. And then, yes, agreed about the stone. There's that Oklahoma stone. Do you know the Oklahoma stone? Yeah. And feels very exotic here.
Yes.
Not so much in Oklahoma. So anyway, it's just kind of interesting to think about that. And, you know, if we want exoticism, you know, so maybe exoticism one place is not another. So for instance, here, you know, I was in Santa Fe recently and out in that area, and those houses felt very exotic to me, those, you know, Pueblo style architecture. And so there it's very common, and but bringing that here would feel kind of special, and probably we would have issues finding someone who knew how to work with it. And so all of these things are somewhat regional.
And then just talking about windows, you started in the beginning of the podcast to start to talk about how you decide how big or how small the windows are in relation to the solid parts of the house. So that's also another part of articulating the facade, is how we're using the glass. And so it's always interesting, because you have to relate it to the inside with whatever floor plan is happening. So maybe the living room is at the front, and do you want big windows or smaller windows, but it's going to look better if we have these bigger windows. Sometimes in some remodels, I've ended up with the master bath at the front of the house, and that's where we might want to have some type of bigger glass. And we kind of have to really think through that and figure that out.
I always wonder when I see those spaces where the garage has nice big windows on it. And I think that as we were talking before we started this podcast, you mentioned sometimes when you're planning those spaces, you add the windows on the garage just to keep that exterior space looking beautiful.
Yeah, so it might be a side entry garage, and you've got this big, massive wall, and maybe what we need to do is add some windows there in order to help work with that articulation in the facade.
So it's about punctuating moments of glass in the space and making sure that those relate to what's happening on the interior, and making sure that when you look through that space, it's not maybe into the shower itself.
Right. Yeah.
Which I have seen that happen, or into a kid's bedroom at the front of a house, or, but, so maybe that's when you lift the windows up high and just have clear story windows or clerestory mm-hmm. windows, or you add, windows, corner windows. I've seen that happen a lot. Those beautiful butt glass corner windows. Mm-hmm. And that gets, I'm happy to see those. That gets it window over to the corner and gives me room for a sofa on the inside of the wall.
And a wall to decorate.
And a wall to decorate. I like walls. So yeah, I think thinking about those punctuations of space and then of course how it affects the inside and how you're going to relate on the inside. And, you know, it's a big brain operation to kind of figure out how all of that works together and get the style of house that the client wants and get the lighting that the client wants.
Right.
So, you know, there's a lot of, sometimes there's conversations of, okay, I've heard Diane tell a story about a client who wanted a lot of light, natural light and windows. Remember the client you've told me about before who mm-hmm. wanted them and then kept cutting the window
yes.
budget?
Yeah.
And you kept reminding her, no, you said you wanted natural light. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes you can do skylights, which I know have a lot of challenges at times for kind of keeping out nature. They can leak. Not so much these days. They used to.
Yeah. And then also sometimes people don't realize like when the leaves fall.
Yeah.
And then you got to get up on the roof and clean them off. And mm-hmm. and also skylights provide a different type of quality of natural light versus windows that are vertical.
Right. And they don't give the view.
Right. Mm-hmm. Although you can see the moon or that's maybe true. Some stars. Mm-hmm. But it just has a different quality of light, which I tend to go more for the clerestory windows than I do the skylights. But sometimes you just can't help it because the room is like in the center of the house and it needs light. And it's a good option and solution for that. So it was interesting. One time I had this professor that said you have to be dictated by the rooms on the inside for what that facade would be on the outside. So if it had a bathroom, you had to have a tiny window. And, it, you know, it was kind of odd to me.
Well, I think you have to go. I'm on his team because
it could be a little bit ugly, though.
That's true. You have to go back and forth. I think it's that, you know, if you want a big window here, then this isn't your shower, but it can be your bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
If you want a big window upstairs here, it can't be maybe your 3-year-old child's room or your teenage child's room. Mm-hmm. You might want a more private experience for them. On the street side. So there's a negotiation that goes on, you know, sometimes it's where's the view?
Mm-hmm.
Is it the front of the house or the back of the house? And everybody wants the front to look a certain way, but everybody wants to engage with the view. And it depends on what you're avoiding looking at, neighbors.
Right, right.
And what you're trying to amplify and enhance. And so it's not thinking it through, it's very obvious. When I walk through a house and I've met a client and when that hasn't been thought through, there are a lot of problems for us to solve on the interiors. If it hasn't, there's unfortunately big, beautiful windows that need to be covered, et cetera, because it's not functional, practical, et cetera. But when it's thought through, it can be magical. And you might be in a space and not even know why you love it so much. But
yeah,
the light is just right where it needs to be. You know, I know last time we were talking in a podcast about windows on two sides of a room. And
my favorite. Yeah. Yes.
And so I think when that works well and it's been thoughtful and thought through and it's not just slap windows wherever we can get them, you end up not having to cover them, being able to live comfortably in the space, having enough storage, having enough privacy as well as enough openness and light. So it's just always a balance. And you say, you know, your professor that talked about you have to have a small window in a bathroom. There are rules we can break for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's just a negotiation and a conversation with the clients about what it is they want to accomplish.
Yeah. And I mean, so I just did a house where we had huge windows in the master bath because it looks out in this amazing view. So.
And I know you and I have done renovations on 1920s, 1930s homes that because of the way contemporary people live, they want a larger closet. And we end up having the closet on the front of the house with windows into the closet. And there's even ways to make that work.
Yeah.
Because we're not taking those big, beautiful windows out. So mm-hmm. anyway, it's a...
Yeah, and you don't want to change it because of the front facade. It would mess it up.
Or, right, right. Maybe it's even historic. So
right. Yes, we have to deal with that a lot. So anyway, that's, I think, all we had to say for now on articulation of facade. It's really important. And those are just all the different things that we're thinking about as we're working on the design.
Thanks for listening.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Design Oracles with Amity Worrell, owner of Amity Worrell & Company, and Diane Kett, owner of DK Studio, and together, partners at Amity Kett.